Open Lines. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'm listening to Issues Etc. It's Monday, July the 21st. The subject I'm laying on the table, coming off our conversation with Helen Hull Hitchcock, the Pope apologizes to the victims of clergy sexual abuse, and that, of course, is something that is necessary, coming from the top down. Hopefully there will be some kind of policies to help prevent this from happening, the benign neglect of bishops and archbishops, that turns out not to be so benign, from ever happening again. But what do you do about it? There are those who say, look, the institution itself, we have to narrow it down to the guilt or the fault of the bishop who let this happen, knowingly let this happen, looked the other way and turned a blind eye. There are criminal penalties for the people who have perpetrated the crimes in clergy sexual abuse. But the civil penalties usually don't go toward the individual. Sometimes the priest who did this, pastor who did this, is long gone or long dead. Should the institution be able to hide behind a statute of limitations for these kind of crimes, the church itself? Or should there be no statute of limitations on what we ask the church to do by way of making restitution for these crimes? I want to know what you think about this. Give it some thought. Give us a call. 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-MYIE, or email us right here in the studio, talkback at issuesetc.org. To get the conversation going, here's a story from ABC News. A bit of a debate between an attorney for the College of Catholic Bishops and a child rights advocate. Listen to what they have to say and then give us a call. 1-877-623-MYIE or talk back at issuesetc.org. What about the civil statute of limitations?
Repeated his pledge to do all possible to heal and to reconcile with clergy sex abuse victims. Sydney Auxiliary Bishop Anthony Fisher characterized the exposure as a small handful dwelling crankily on old wounds. Needless to say, the comments set off a firestorm of reaction. One of the major flashpoints in this country with regards all child abuse is the statutes of limitations for prosecution that exist in some states. Joining us to wade into these murky waters is Marcy Hamilton, a leading church state scholar and lawyer, who has a new book, Justice Denied: What America Must Do to Protect Its Children. And joining us from Washington is Mark Chopko, a lawyer who is chair of Stradley Ronan's nonprofit and religious organizations practice group. He has more than 20 years of experience serving as the principal legal officer to the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Marcy, let's begin with you. So you say that the statute of limitations on legal actions by victims of sex abuse should be eliminated totally.
Absolutely. The problem is that victims of child sex abuse need decades to come forward. It's just a fact. Many don't come forward until their 40s, their 50s, and in many states, if they don't come forward by the age of 20 or 21, they're shut out of court, and the result is the predators get legal protection.
Okay, now, Mark, you have a differing opinion on this. Why do you think that they should be retained?
Well, when you're talking about statute of limitations for going after the predators, the people who cause the abuse, I share the conviction that the criminal statutes of limitations should be eliminated prospectively, and that people should be able to bring claims against or should be able to file for criminal prosecutions against those people who abuse them. I think where the disagreement comes is on the civil side, and on the civil side when it deals with institutions. We all agree that victims deserve compassion, they deserve outreach, they deserve reconciliation, they deserve healing. They deserve to be taken seriously, frankly, and to receive apologies and care. I guess the view that I've come to over a lot of experience is that I don't think that the litigation system is best suited to do that.
All right, now he's laid out his viewpoint here, and the woman on the other side of the issue has laid out hers. They both agree that the criminal penalty should have no statute of limitations. If a priest abuses a young boy, even if it is discovered 50 years later, there should still be the possibility of criminal prosecution. And very few people disagree with that. The question here is, for how long should the institution, that is the church, be required to answer for these crimes? And we're talking about dollars and cents. We're talking about not just apologies, but also payments, settlements. The Roman Catholic Church, some of its dioceses, have made huge settlements with the victims of clergy sexual abuse? What if someone comes forward 25 years from now as an old man? Should the church still be required to make a settlement then? I want to hear from you. 1-877-623-MYIE. Talk back at issuesetc.org. 877-623-MYIE or talk back at issuesetc.org.
Numbers in California that some have said show that something on the order of 80 to 90% of the cases that were filed under California's revival of lapsed claims were filed against Catholic institutions and 10% against everybody else. I think the issue here is whether we want to try to create mechanisms to create incentives for people to come forward.
Okay, well, Marcy, what about this argument that when a certain amount of time passes, it's almost impossible to defend yourself? I mean, some of these cases, right, these clergy have been dead for 40 years.
Right.
So what about they can't defend themselves?
Well, actually, the burden is placed on the plaintiff in the first instance, and so the defense comes after that. If the plaintiff can't prove the case, it's not going to go to court. You know, Mark's talking about the cases in California. There were about 800 against the church, a little over 1,000 that were filed, partly because of all of the knowledge that we now have about the abuse within the church. None of those cases were beaten back as either inadequate evidence or false. Actually, what happened is the church actually had caused a great deal of the abuse by hiding the identity of the predators. So what we're dealing with here is fundamental justice.
Mark, your response to that?
A couple points. One, I don't think that litigation is the best way in which we can heal and reconcile people. Litigation is about revenge and vindication and compensation. And speaking myself as a litigator, I don't see that many people are healed by that process. What the church has tried to do is have very strong and aggressive victim assistance programs, victim outreach programs, and programs that are designed towards healing and reconciliation. In 2002 alone, following through on the bishop's commitment to end abuse in the church, the bishops of the United States removed over 700 people permanently from ministry.
Not that I'm biased here, but that is actually going to have to be the final word. I want to thank you both for joining me.
All right, there's the story from ABC News. Both sides of this issue have been heard. On the civil penalties, that is, when the institution is called to answer for the crimes that it either permitted to be committed, knew were being committed, or found out later and did nothing about it. How long should they be required to make restitution? It was about 2003 when the first big cases were being heard in the United States. And people began to realize, the public began to realize that this was a problem that was endemic in the American Catholic Church. Now, a lot of money's been paid out. What about 25 years from now, an old man shows up with his attorney and says, well, 60 years ago, I was the victim of clergy sexual abuse. Should the church still at that distant point in time be required to make restitution or to answer for it? Or should there be something like a statute of limitations? I want to hear from you. 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-MYIE, or email us here in the studio. It's Monday, the 21st of July. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk back at issuesetc.org. Talk back at issuesetc.org. I don't know if I've ever talked about this on the air before, but I think I have. I actually had some dealings with an attorney who came knocking at my congregation's door when I was a parish pastor, because one of the previous pastors there had done this very thing with a young person in the congregation. And families of subsequent pastoral abuse were doing a little investigating and finding out how this guy made it to their church to abuse their children. When I informed the church official over my head about this, you know what he told me? Don't talk to that lawyer. Keep quiet. Don't let him see anything. Needless to say, I didn't follow that church official's advice. Here's Barry in Pennsylvania. Let's see what he has to say. Hi, Barry.
Hey, Todd. This is kind of a painful issue. My first wife, I caught her in a compromising situation, and suddenly it all came tumbling out after a few years of marriage that she had been a victim of childhood sexual abuse, raped repeatedly while she was 12 years old. She ended up divorcing me. She couldn't stay in the marriage, and not long after that, she tried to commit suicide. At that point, a psychiatric care was running about $1,000 a day, and my health insurance policy covered the first 2 weeks. It was nothing.
Hmm.
She then turned to the church and asked for help, not a financial settlement. She asked for help with her counseling, her treatment. And here's a person who almost died in a suicide attempt. She was had a blood a pulse rate of like 15 when they found her. She's a terribly troubled person even to this day. She's not as bad as she was, but you know, when we say no, you can't go after the church. We're saying no, you can't get the money to pay for the psychiatric care. No, you can't get the money to pay for the counseling. We're talking about something a great deal more important here. I mean, there was a person who, no fault of their own, has had her life just turned into a bizarre circus, and it's not fair to them, and they need help. They desperately need help. And if that man comes out 40 years later and says, I need help, well, then maybe he does.
All right, Barry, thank you very much. We'll hear from the rest of you on the other side of this break. It's Audio Open Lines. Stay tuned.
Some members of Congress are eager to pass legislation that would use federal funds for research that involves removing stem cells from human embryos. So, what's the big deal? Removing stem cells from human embryos kills them. Embryos are human beings at their earliest stages. Embryos have begun the process of developing after fertilization and have everything necessary to develop into adults just like you or me. They only need time, nourishment, and a safe place to grow. Adult stem cells retrieved from ethical sources are already being used to help cure patients with a variety of conditions in clinical settings every day. And every day, successful new treatments are being developed. So, with so many promising treatments being developed from adult stem cells, why use our tax dollars to destroy innocent human life? Send the message to Congress that we want funding for ethical treatments that work, not for research that requires killing human embryos. This has been a perspective on life from National Right to Life at www.nrlc.org.
New technology, old theology. You're listening to Issues, etc.
618-223-8384. It's the new phone number for the Issues, etc. listener comment line. 618-223-8384. Leery about calling a live radio talk show? Want to remain anonymous? Leave your recorded question or comment on the Issues, Etc. comment line, 618-223-8384. The good, the bad, the ugly. We're big boys. We can take it. 618-223-8384.
On behalf of the staff of Issues, Etc., thanks to each and every one of the more than 7,500 who signed the online petition to bring Issues, Etc. back. James Casey, Barbara Needham, Pastor David Radke, Barry Hammond, Pastor Kenneth Bunge, Elizabeth Wiley, Gerald Kapanka, Glenda Mummy, Adam Sorensen, and Pastor Richard Zeely. Thanks for your support. Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., the new atheists. Greg Kokel, not one of them, will be joining us to talk about what's so new about the new atheists. It's Audio Open Lines. We're discussing a little bit of a debate that's going on in legal circles, but I think it's something that even the layperson can chime in on. I certainly have to, when I hear Barry talk about his wife, and before the break he calls in talking about the victim of sexual abuse and the fact that medical bills for psychiatric care can run $1,000 a day, you start realizing why some of the payouts, say in the California Archdiocese, Southern California, have been as large as they have been in the sexual abuse scandal in the Roman Catholic Church. So should there be a statute of limitations on the civil penalties that the institution, the church, might be asked to pay for allowing, permitting, turning a blind eye to the sexual abuse that takes place not only in the Roman Catholic Church but elsewhere as well. 1-877-623-MYIE. Talk back at issuesetc.org. Nancy writes, when has money ever really substituted for justice? Well, that's a good question, Nancy. But I don't think the victims of sexual abuse are asking for money to substitute for justice. Remember, there are criminal penalties that can be brought against the perpetrators of these crimes. I think there should be criminal penalties brought against the bishops or the church officials who knew that it was happening and did nothing, or who knew that it was happening and allowed the priest to go from parish to parish. There should be criminal penalties there, too. But when the victim asks for restitution, he's not so much asking for justice in the legal sense as much as compensation for the pain and the suffering. And while money can't substitute for justice, it does pay doctor's bills very well. Don in Kansas says this, we do have people out here who will make up a charge in order just to get money. Some hate the Christian church and will do anything to get back at the Christian church. When we have a charge that is over 10 years old, something may be wrong. We never see things like that in the public schools, and I know that there are a lot of abuse in public schools. It is usually the back page of the newspaper if we get it at all. It seems it all gets covered up and a small payoff and the teacher goes to jail. Well, that may well be, and certainly we cannot discount the fact that the Roman Catholic Church in this case is perceived as having extremely deep pockets. And I will tell you that every church, every congregation, every church body is insured to the hilt on issues like this. And for good reason. But remember, we're talking about, let's say for the sake of argument, that 10% of these are made up. We're still talking about 90%, 9 out of 10 of these charges being genuine. And a lot of times the abuse began, went on, occurred, and nothing was done about it, largely because the institution of the church had set itself up to say nothing when this happens. Should there be a statute of limitations on the civil penalties that churches should have to pay, church bodies or denominations? Bob in Vermont writes, some observations, the statute of limitations for sexual offenses varies by state from state to state. Number one, it's very important that any repeal of the statute of limitations for sexual crimes, civil or criminal, be made by legislatures, not by judicial fiat. That's true. Number two, there needs to be some limitation to protect innocent people from false accusation. Now remember, we even heard in that ABC News story that the burden of proof lies with the plaintiff, be it in criminal or civil court. That is, you bring the complaint, you bear the burden of proof. Even the priests that people say, okay, he was doing this, he is still presumed in court, presumed innocent until proven guilty. He says the Roman Church in the U.S. in the past decades frequently turned a blind eye to sexual activity. Now it is criticized for its rules against homosexual priests. I'd argue that encouraging sexual morality in the church would benefit everyone. That's true. Well, there's the untold story in the sexual priestly scandal. The untold story is we're talking about homosexuality in the priesthood. We're talking about a significant percentage of the priests being gay. And we're talking about the fact that much of this wasn't pedophilia, but was in fact pederasty. Homosexual encounters between men and young boys. And we're not, and in a lot of cases, look it up, look up, do the research. In a lot of cases, the ages of the boys weren't prepubescent, but postpubescent. Now, why is that significant? It's significant for this reason. We're not talking about, in most of these cases, we're not talking about a priest who is a pedophile. We're talking about a priest who is gay and preys upon young men. It's a far more complicated issue than just sexual abuse, as complicated as that is. Susan in Dallas writes, if we decide the church has a statute of limitations when victims can address what happened, are we absolving them of all future responsibility for hiring sexual molesters in the future? It seems that this is an ongoing problem, and keeping the church responsible will keep them more careful in whom they ordain and maintain in the ministry. Wouldn't keeping the church responsible help them continue to police themselves better? I think it would. I do think it would. What do the rest of you think? 1-877-623-MY-IE, 877-623-MY-IE, or email us, talkback@issuesetc.org. Should there be a statute of limitations on any kind of penalty or settlement the church should pay when there are incidents of priestly sexual abuse? 1-877-623-MY-IE, talkback@issuesetc.org. On the other side of this break, we're going to be talking about Ezekiel. Dr. Andrew Steinman will be our guest professor of theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago, a regular guest. Looking forward to talking to him again. And then later in that second hour, Dr. David Menton will be our guest. We'll talk about creation and evolution. Is there a halfway house between the two? A detente between Darwin's Origin of the Species and Genesis chapters 1 and 2? Sad to say, many Christians think there is. That's coming up here in just a few minutes. Here's a little something near the end of Audio Open Lines to make you think. The economy is shaky. Gas costs a lot. Mortgages are failing. What are some people doing? Listen.
On a hot summer day, people trek to this 70-year-old grotto in the Bronx, New York, for the water. Traditionally, people believe the water produced miracles. Now, more people are praying instead for peace and calm in turbulent economic times.
It's like a real drastic change with the gas prices.
If you can't be led to these spiritual waters, more Americans are flocking to spirits themselves. Tarot card reader Susan Levitt in San Francisco reports a surge in people looking for divine intervention.
There are many more questions about property, real estate. Do I quit my job and freelance?
So clients are not asking, will I ever get married?
Supposedly that when times are tough, the three biggest businesses are psychics, cosmetics, a woman will buy a lipstick to feel better, and luxury items, because the top 3% will still be buying their Bentleys.
Very interesting, people flocking to the fortune tellers, the tarot card readers. When things are going bad, they want to know, should they invest here, should they invest there? Is this a good idea? Was that a good idea? Did you know that all religions, save the Christian faith, can essentially be boiled down to one word? Superstition. What is superstition? It is the simple belief that whatever you do manipulates the powers that be, the gods, the forces of the universe, call it whatever you want to call it. That whatever you do manipulates the universe, either against you or for you. That's superstition. And every religion, no matter how sophisticated, no matter how ancient, no matter how well pedigreed, no matter how well respected, every religion other than the true Christian faith is superstition. It may have a very complicated system of theology, but if it is, God acts, God waits for you do, then God responds. You obey, God favors you. You act bad, God disfavors you. You know, some Christians actually think that's what Christianity is. Christianity is the opposite of superstition. We do not manipulate God into doing against or for us in any way whatsoever. It's about a God who comes into the world and bears our sins in his body on the cross, who comes in and lives a perfect life, not because he's afraid something bad might happen if he doesn't, but he lives that perfect life for you and for me because we can't. And he frees us from all fear, which is at the root of superstition, that what we do or don't do is going to either win or fail to win God's favor. He won God's favor for us at the cross. His name is Jesus Christ. That's why Christianity is different from all other religions. All other religions are a you-do religion. Sad to say, that's being preached in a lot of Christian pulpits, too, in the name of Christianity. But whether it comes out of the mouth of a Christian preacher or out of a tarot card reader, it's still superstition and not the Christian faith. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Ezekiel with Dr. Andrew Steinman.
Weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 1046, San Juan Capistrano, California, 92693. Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.